should start by saying that this talk comes from a mix of ignorance and confusion. From a place of ignorance and confusion. A place of confusion because part of the point of the talk is to explain some confusions I have with the notion of biased information, trying to give an account of what it would be, but also trying to sort of show that sort of the most straightforward accounts that you might come up with don't work. So, and I'm more convinced that straightforward accounts don't work than I'm convinced that my account works. Hence, mainly confusion. Place of ignorance because this is very much work in progress. I'm trying out things. Hopefully, I have some interesting things to say, but I'm also hoping for input, for suggestions, for alternatives. I'll apologize a little bit for the ignorance bit. Sometimes it's nice to be told more stuff. I won't apologize for the confusion because it's philosophy and it's all about confusion. So my topic is biased information, and I'm going to start by one of the main aims that I have here is to sort of argue that there's an interesting class here, that there's an interesting topic here, separated out from sort of like from similar topics. So that's going to be the first thing I'm trying to do. And I think it helps to start with some examples. So if you've been in the UK over the last year or so, you'll probably have received leaflets from the Vote Leave and the Vote Remain campaigns, which are sources of information. There's some information on them. In particular, they cite a bunch of facts and kind of grant that everything that's on these leaflets is true. So for example, the Vote Leave leaflet might include facts such as that the UK has to pay in sort of £350 million a week into the EU fund. Or it might include facts such as that the UK is the country whose proposals most frequently get voted down in the European Parliament. And also include facts like that Britain imports more from the EU than it exports to the EU, suggesting that if Britain leaves, it'll still be in the EU's interest to continue trading. And all of the things that it'll contain will be truths, I'm assuming. Still, you might think that there's sort of something off about the leaflet, or at least that it doesn't give you a sort of full, complete, absolutely adequate account of how good it would be for the UK to leave the EU. There's nothing unique here about the Leave leaflet, by the way. I'm sure exactly the same thing is true of the Remain leaflet. It's just that, given my Facebook feed, I'm much more sensitive to the sort of various ways in which the Leave feed is misleading and biased than I am to the ways in which the Remain one is. Why is it biased? Well, roughly the thought is, here's a bunch of stuff that it didn't tell you. It gave you the facts that I mentioned, but it doesn't say, for example, that half of the £350 million a week get returned to the UK via various programs immediately. So in that sense, it already sort of fails to put that figure into context. And once you put it into context, it's no longer quite as strong a reason to leave. It doesn't tell you that the reason why the UK loses sort of more votes or makes sort of more failed proposals in the European Parliament is that the UK insists, unlike other countries, on running motions that they know that will fail, just to make a point. So again, once you include that information, that sort of contextualizing information, it casts a slightly different light on it. It also won't include lots of other information that might be reasons for staying. So it won't, for example, mention that it'll be very hard to on the British economy, or that at least most economists forecast that it'll be hard on the British economy for Britain to leave the EU, and that ultimately means that less money will be available, and so even if some money is saved because it no longer has to be spent, it's not clear that that means that there's a net gain. So none of these are really criticisms. I don't think we expect any better of political leaflets, and as I said, more or less the same is true with the Remain leaflet. I mean, no one really expects a political leaflet that's campaigning for a certain cause to be an unbiased, give you an unbiased account of the matter. But there are other cases where maybe we do expect such a thing. So other cases of biased information where we do expect such a thing. So, for example, from a history textbook, you might expect you have higher standards. And there, too, there are sort of fairly obvious cases in which a history textbook can contain only truths and yet give you a distorted picture of reality. For example, a textbook on U.S. history, and particularly on U.S. history leading up to the secession by the Southern states and the formation of the Confederacy right before the Civil War, might contain lots of information about how, basically from its foundation and up until now, much of American politics has been many of the political struggles in the U.S. have focused on the questions of states' rights versus federal, strong federal governments. And it'll include some facts that illustrate this, and that is true. This is one of the big political debates in the U.S. It'll also maybe include facts like, it may include sort of quotes from advocates of leaving or advocates of succession and forming the Confederacy that talk about the importance of states' rights, and that is like the sort of federal overreach, as we now call it, I don't know if they called it that back then, that the federal overreach is a main reason for, is like a really important reason for the southern states to secede from the Union. That the overreach concerns slavery, or in particular the sort of the attempt to ban slavery, is sort of orthogonal or sort of downplayed in many of those tests. And everything that you're getting there is true, as in that is what people would say, or what many people wrote about. And so the book is merely reporting truths. Nonetheless, it gives you a distorted picture. For example, it might omit the fact that many of those arguing for states' rights, in this case, had sort of just 10 years previously argued against states' rights when the question was whether northern states should be required to send back escaped slaves to the south. Which was an instance of sort of federal law reaching into states' rights. And so it gives you sort of, while it consists only of truths, it still gives you sort of a biased picture of what the motivation was for sort of southern states to secede from the Union. Or at least, if you are not convinced that that's how it's actually happening, that's the actual truth, you can treat this as a sort of liberal fantasy, but it's clearly as a conceptual possibility. Now, these cases seem to have something in common. These are cases which you might call some cases of biased accounts. And they seem to have something in common with cases of sort of less sort of politically charged cases, but cases of biased data sets, where you have some information that, again, has a sort of, it consists only of truths, but casts a biased, or gives you sort of a weird picture, in some way a distorted picture of what's going on. The most famous case of, this is the case of sort of biased samples, as they're called in statistics. So the most famous illustration of this is to Eddington. He imagines you show up at this lake, and you're wondering, hey, I wonder how big the fish in this lake are. And so what you do is you start catching some fish with your net, and you measure them, and you do that a lot of times, and then you've measured a bunch of fish, and then you draw some kind of conclusion, or maybe not. But it turns out that the net that you've been using is an extremely coarse net. It has sort of holes that are pretty big, so it actually is only able to catch large fish. With this net, you'll never catch any small fish. And so there's a sort of bias in the data set that you've got. The data set might suggest that the fish in the lake are large, but that's not because in doing that, it's suggesting, it's giving you a biased picture of what the sort of size of fish in that lake is actually like. This seems similar in an important, I feel like in most of the important features, and maybe this is already the first sort of controversial substantive claim, but that there's something importantly similar between the campaign leaflet and history books and what's going on in the data set that you get from fishing with a large net. The thought is that in all of these cases you have evidence that's in some way not great. The information that you're getting is in some way distorting, And it's because of sort of the systematic omission of certain kinds of information. In the textbook, it's a systematic omission of things that would sort of suggest a different motivation for the southern states to succeed, or in the political leaflet, it's the systematic omission of information that would suggest drawbacks to leaving the EU. In the fishing example, it's the systematic omission from the data set of fish that are smaller than your net can catch. So that's all three of these are, I think, are cases that I'm going to call cases of biased information. There's something with this information that's weird. Just to have a fourth case, this case is like the least vivid, and it's like the most indicative of me being a formal epistemologist, at least sometimes. But it's something that's nonetheless helpful. So like, imagine that there's this coin that's been tossed like 1,000 times, because that's what, as formal epistemologists, think about mostly. The core question of epistemology. And now we have some. Now someone's going to write down some of the results of the coin toss. They're not going to write down all of them. And then they could use a method, something like this. They could, if it's for each outcome, they sort of look. If it's a heads, then with 80% probability, they write it down. If it's a tails, then with only 20% probability, they write it down. So what you get is everything that's on this list is accurate, but there's a sort of systematic bias in what makes it on the list. The reason why I think that case would be helpful, one is that it's very simple, but another one is that it's a case where the biasing is not deterministic, it's not perfect. It could turn out, I mean, it's unlikely, but it could turn out that actually only the tails ones get written down and none of the heads ones get written down. So the sort of biasing process is not guaranteed to be successful. That will matter shortly. All right, so all of these are cases of biases in the information. I'm using that term. I want to distinguish that very briefly from a different form of bias, which is what you might call bias in how some information is represented. In particular, you might know that I'm paying attention at all. You might know that, not to me, just to the world, that we are susceptible to various sort of biases in our reasoning. That there are certain kinds of evidence that we tend to overrate, other kinds of evidence that we tend to downplay. That's just a psychological fact about almost all people. And this is not really that surprising. I mean, if you tell people that you tend to overestimate the value of sort of really vivid, really detailed personal examples and underestimate the sort of significance of greater statistics, that's not... We didn't need social psychology to work that out for us. We all kind of knew that all along. And there's a bunch of more sophisticated and subtler effects like this. And so there's many things that you can do when you're writing a book, say, to encourage people to draw certain conclusions. You can, and this is, again, I mean, that you can do this is just more or less the fact that there is such an art as rhetoric. You can structure things so as to make them more convincing or less convincing. You can put the sort of the strongest arguments last, because that's where they'll have the greatest impact, that kind of thing. Or you can, that's one kind of bias. Another kind of bias is again kind of similar, is that maybe we tend to underestimate certain kinds of, another kind of evidence that I think we probably tend to underestimate is that we tend to dismiss testimony coming from certain groups, say because of maybe prejudices or false beliefs about that group, or just because of entirely not even anything as conscious as a belief, but something much more automated that makes us downplay the significance of that. All of those are cases where there's a bias in how you respond to some information, and that could be exploited in how the information is presented. But I want to distinguish that from a bias in the information itself. One reason to do that, especially if you're an epistemologist, is that you tend to think that all of these biases in how we evaluate some information, those are ways in which we fall short of being perfectly rational. They exploit ways in which people are just not that great at forming the beliefs justified by their evidence. And so when something like that happens, the beliefs that people form won't be reasonable beliefs. They won't be justified beliefs. And that's quite different from what seems to happen when you have some information that's biased, and then you use that to draw some inferences. There it seems like, at least if you don't know, if you have no reason to suspect that the information would be biased in this way, and so on, then it seems like you are quite reasonable in drawing those inferences. There's a sense in which the beliefs that you come up with are the reasonable beliefs for you to have. Another way to bring this out, I think, is pretty much the same point, is that bias, that the sort of presentation of the evidence that goes via triggering biases in how we evaluate it works because of sort of very contingent features of us. While that we can be sort of tricked by biased information really only relies on sort of two things. It relies on the fact that we sometimes make inferences based on incomplete information. That sometimes we only have access to incomplete information, and second, that sometimes we make inferences based on those. As long as that's the case, you can sort of feed people incomplete information in sort of systematic ways and thereby get them to form beliefs in this way. And those are sort of pretty non-contingent or much less contingent features of humans, that we have these two features, and you might think those are features of us that are good. That we only have access to limited information is neutral, but that we draw inferences based on it nonetheless is surely something that's right. That's something that we should be doing. One case that's a little bit tricky to categorize here on this distinction, which I'd love to talk about more but probably can't, is what to say about biases that result from a judicious choice of concepts. So which concepts you use to formulate the information. And essentially, I think actually that how a bias like that, like for example, whether you report somebody, I don't know, to have a really hackneyed example, whether you report someone as a freedom fighter or as a terrorist is the sort of a classic example of this. I think actually that those are interesting cases because sometimes they work one way, sometimes they work the other way. So sometimes the two concepts that you could be using really are equivalent. They really do pick out the same things, but they sort of suggest different inferences. But sometimes they communicate different information. They actually give you different information, and that might result in a bias in the information. So actually, in the freedom fighter terrorist case, it seems to me like not only do these terms sort of carry different connotations, they are also extensionally slightly different. One thing tells you about what means the person is inclined to use, the other one tells you what their ends are, and there isn't sort of a sort of very strict connection between them. So in those kinds of cases, the choice of concepts will result in biased information, in my sense, but other cases maybe are not like that. Okay, so that's the phenomenon and a little bit of discussion of how it's different from other cases. Now I want to discuss how it connects to some other related issues. In particular, how bias in the evidence connects to it being misleading, how it connects to it being partial, how it connects to the source of the evidence, or the sort of what process was being used to put this evidence together. I think all of those are in the sort of naive thought is that biased evidence is something about selection. There's something about selective omission. There's something misleading. There's something incomplete. All of these, I think, are sort of naturally in there. And the question is what exactly the connections are. Before I get to that, I think there's a quick clarification that will be useful, which is that really when we talk about information being biased, the core notion should be information being biased on some issue, on some question. The reason being that the same piece of information can give you a sort of totally unbiased picture of one kind of, one aspect of reality, while giving you a very biased picture of another. You might say that the campaign leaflet does give you an unbiased picture of the disadvantages of leaving the EU, which is something that you might want an unbiased picture of. Maybe you think it doesn't even achieve that. But you can imagine other cases where something gives you an unbiased picture of the disadvantages of something, without thereby giving you an unbiased picture of whether this would be a good thing to do, because it only focuses on the disadvantages. I think the sort of question of relativity is responsible for some of the features that make bias hard to pin down or hard to accuse somebody of. For example, normally it's not clear what the question is that someone is setting out, or they're not committed to a particular answer to what the question is that they're presenting their information as information regarding. They just give you some information. Then you come across with a particular question and you say, actually, relative to that question, it gives it a biased or a problematic description. And then one thing that they can say in response is, yeah, but that was not the question I was intending to answer. So you've just sort of, by criticizing me for being biased, you've taken me to be doing something that I wasn't really doing. And often that response will be disingenuous. I think it's part of what's responsible for why it's hard to make accusations of bias stick. A related application of this, just to mention it briefly, is that often whether or not something is biased seems like a very loaded, normatively loaded question. So whether this is something that Elizabeth Anderson brings up very nicely in her discussion of objectivity and feminist epistemology, where she points out that the information that you get and from the sort of history textbook is biased or not, might itself be American history textbook I was imagining, whether that is counts as biased or not might itself depend on sort of, might itself be something that's controversial, and not just controversial because the facts are controversial. And part of the controversy, or part of the role of value judgments in this debate, will presumably be about which questions matter. So which questions we should be trying to answer. And so there's a certain role for value judgments to enter here into choosing which questions bias matters relative to, which isn't sort of, and therefore a role for value judgments to enter sort of into the very aims of science, because scientific theories, just like historical theories or historical accounts, want to give not just a true picture of the matter, but a sort of true and unbiased in the relevant kind of ways, pictures of the matter. And so settling on which questions bias matters relative to is going to be one of those places where values can enter. All right, I'm going to... there's more interesting things to say about the question of relativity. I'm going to try and actually make progress in giving an account of what biased information is now. I've probably already said this, but I think the notion of information being biased is most interesting when it consists only of truths. When the information is false, and the question of bias in a way doesn't really arise. And the information is bad because it's false. It doesn't matter whether it's in addition biased or not very much. And so I think the notion of bias is most interesting when applied to true information. So that's what I'm going to be talking about. That's how I see it as connecting with the notion of information being false. It's only really interesting once the information is granted as being true. Another thing that's very tempting to say about biased information is that it's misleading. The history textbook gives you a misleading account of what motivated the secession from the by the southern states from the U.S. That seems extremely natural to say, but I think at least on the way that philosophers normally define misleading, I'll come back to that later in the talk. But at least on the way that philosophers normally define misleading, there can't be a very tight connection between some information being biased and it being misleading. Because the standard definition for evidence to be misleading is for it to, or misleading on some question, is for it to support a false answer to that question. So evidence for P is misleading if P is false. where evidence is proceeding relative to P, if it's evidence for P and P is false, or evidence against P and P is true. There's also something right about that definition, so this is something that I'm puzzled about. But if you have that notion, if that's the notion, I think there just isn't any tight connection between bias and misleadingness. It doesn't seem like misleadingness is sufficient, because information can be pointing you towards the false for all kinds of ways. Bias is just sort of one way. But more importantly, it doesn't seem like it's necessary. For example, one way that you can point that out is that if you were convinced by my thought that both the campaign leaflets were biased and were biased as related to the question of whether it would be good for the UK to leave the EU. I mean, either it would be good for the UK to leave the EU or it wouldn't. And so they can't both be supporting, and they support different verdicts, so they can't both be supporting the false verdict. One of them has got to be supporting the true verdict. And so if that's all it takes for something to not be misleading, then they can't both be misleading. I hope that brings out why really misleadingness, at least understood in this way, is not a necessary feature of bias. A third sort of notion, or a third sort of imperfection in our evidence, or in some information, is that it might be incomplete. It gives you an incomplete picture. I think it is quite plausible that incompleteness is necessary for the thing to be biased, but I hope it's also clear that it's very obviously not sufficient. So lots of accounts are incomplete on some question, and yet sort of manage to portray their subject matter fairly. If you want a sort of clear example, you can imagine in the coin tossing case that, you know, just every second coin toss is being written down. It doesn't matter whether it's head or tails, it's just every second one is going to be written down. Then you still get partial information about the sort of distribution of heads and tails, but it doesn't in any way seem biased. So incompleteness may be, again, necessary, but it's clearly not sufficient. So in a way, we're still not there when it comes to giving an account of biased information. More promising, I think, is the thought that whether information is biased or not is just a sort of historical question about the process by which it was put together. And that helped bring in the sort of idea of selectivities, that, well, when the information is being accumulated, written into the book, or evidence being gathered by you, there's a bias in how that happens, and that bias is then in the information. So it's a little bit like what Nozick says about justice, that like the result is just if and only if it's reached via just sort of transactions. I guess the starting point has to be just, but ignore that. And so some information is biased if and only if it was sort of assembled by a biased process. The first worries you might think is, isn't that circular? You're using bias to analyze bias. But I don't think that's a terribly worrying feature, because bias in a process is quite a different thing from bias in some information. And in particular, the notion of bias as applied to a process is much easier, I think, to get a handle on, in part because we have a handle on it outside of the realm of sort of information and evidence and outside the epistemic realm at all. So we have the notion of something, a game being biased, or a die being loaded and thus being biased. And what that means roughly is that it's more likely to land on, say, 6 than in some sense it ought to be, than it normally would be. That's what it is for the process to be biased, or for the die to be biased. And similarly, what it is for a selection process of, say, a candidate for a job to be biased in favor of, say, white men, is for white men to be more likely to get the job than they would be if it was sort of ordinary, normal kind of case. Hard to know what normal there means if you think that almost all cases are cases where the process is biased, but in a particular direction. But I'm not going to try and answer that question yet. What I'm trying to gesture at is just that it seems like this notion of bias is easier to understand on its own terms and in connection with other notions than the notion of biased information. So we can use the sort of general notion of a process being biased and apply it to an evidence putting together process, such as an investigation, an inquiry, where you're gathering some evidence, but also such as the writing of a book, where you're assembling a sort of collection of information that's putting pieces into. And we can say that it's biased if biased towards producing evidence for P if sort of the probability that the end product will be evidence for P is antecedently higher than it ought to be, than it would normally be. I think that's not quite the right notion, but it's roughly in the area. And you can see also that most of the cases, or all of the cases where intuitively the information is biased, do seem like cases where there was a process that led to the information being put together that was biased. So plausibly, I mean, the sort of clearest case of this is the Eddington case where you have these fish. I mean, the process by which this was happening made it extremely likely that the resulting evidence would be evidence that the fish in this lake are very large. But plausibly, this is also the case with the campaign leaflet or the apologist history textbook. These are cases where the process by which the information was put together and by which people made decisions about what to include or not to include made it much more likely that it would end up containing evidence for leaving the EU or evidence that the states were seceding because of states' rights rather than slavery than it would have been otherwise. And process here can be understood fairly broadly. It doesn't have to include only sort of the conscious decisions of the people. It might include sort of what kind of information they had available to them. Again, I'm not going to try and answer that. So that's a nice proposal. The proposal being, okay, now some evidence is biased if it came from a biased evidence assembly process. It's kind of like a robot assembly process. But I don't think that account can be right. Here are two problem cases for the simple account. One is that if you have a sort of indeterministic biasing process, then it might be that what you get, even though the process is biased towards getting evidence for P, nonetheless you end up with evidence for not P. Right? So you do the coin thing where you're more likely to report heads outcomes and tails outcomes, but it just so happens that you only report the tails outcomes this time. Or you're really looking to try and find the evidence that leaving the EU would be a good thing, but you're just really bad at it. And so all you can come up with is like reasons why it'd be great to stay in the EU. And so your campaign leaflet like has all these great arguments for staying in the EU despite your best attempts. I mean, in those cases, the process is still biased. The process still made it unlikely that you would have an outcome like this. But here it is, the outcome. It seems to me like it'd be very weird to say that the information that you get is biased towards P, if in fact it's towards not P. Okay, so you might say, maybe that just means we have to add a clause. We have to just say, well, it's evidence for P, and it came from a process that was biased towards P. Or maybe more plausibly, it's evidence for P because of the bias in the process towards P. This is debited here to Paulina. But I think that's plausible enough, and that's not terribly gerrymandered. But I think there's other problem cases too. So here's another kind of case that I'm worried about. Suppose that the process is such that a biased process that's biased towards P nonetheless gives you conclusive evidence that P. So an example might be you ask me whether you're popular. That process is biased because in fact, you know, if you're popular, I'll just say, yeah, yeah, everyone loves you, you're great. If you're not popular, I'll just like waffle on a bit and say, but like, yeah, you know, that guy, Joe, he thinks you're okay, and, you know, and then change the topic. So you're not going to get much evidence out of me in that case, either way. So the process is biased because it sort of has some chance of giving strong evidence for P, and no chance of giving sort of substantial evidence against not P, at least if you don't, I mean, suppose you don't know this about me, and so you and you're not like socially aware enough to take this into account when you filter the results. But now suppose, I mean, what if it's the case where you ask me whether you're popular and I give you the conclusive evidence, I'm like, yeah, you're popular, everyone likes you, you're the most popular person I've ever met, and so on. And that's true. Again, it seems to me slightly weird to describe this as a biased account. I'm not omitting anything. I'm telling you everything there is to be told. How could that possibly be a biased account? Even though it comes from a biased source. All right. Again, we could just build this in as a further clause. You know, oh, I better not give you conclusive evidence. But I think at that point we've sort of reached the point where it now starts to feel like, well, maybe this is extensionally correct, but it's not very helpful in helping me understand what it was for some information to be biased. But here's, I think, something that might help. We could say, I mean, one thing that these two problem cases have in common is that in those problem cases, learning about the bias wouldn't actually defeat the sort of support which the evidence gives to the conclusion in question. So if the evidence that you have is evidence for P, and then you learn that the process was biased against P, that only strengthens the sort of support for P. It only makes it sort of, if even the bias process yielded all this evidence for P, then surely P must be true. Similarly, if you have conclusive evidence for P, then finding out that you got this evidence from a sort of mechanism that might have given you less if it happened in the case, won't affect anything. It's just sort of an interesting counterfactual truth about the process by which you got it. It doesn't in any way undermine the impact that the information has on the claim that you're popular. So.
Sorry, I was just trying to check the time. 5 more minutes.
Excellent. So what you have in those cases is that ordinarily learning that the information was accumulated via a biased process, a process that made it more likely to yield evidence for P than against P. If you add that information about the bias into the information, it no longer supports P. It defeats the sort of support that you originally got from the thing. So, like, if you have this list where it says that, like, all of these coins landed heads, but then you find out that, you know, they only ever told you about the heads coins, then that significantly defeats the sort of initial support that you had for thinking that the coin landed heads more often than it landed heads. But in the counterexample kind of cases, this doesn't hold. In the counterexample, if you have sort of conclusive evidence, then learning about the bias in the or complete evidence, and learning about the bias in the process won't defeat it, because it'll just tell you that, well, you might have received less evidence, but in fact you got everything there was to know it, so there's no problem here. Similarly, if the information actually already points towards P, despite the bias towards not P, then adding the information about the bias will only sort of strengthen its support towards P. So that, I think, is maybe a more promising proposal. The idea being that if some evidence is biased, or some information is biased regarding a question, if the truth about the compilation process would sort of change the direction in which it bears on that question. All right. Is that a correct account? Here's something that might be a counterexample, or it might not be. I have something to say. I don't know how good it is. Suppose you use some sort of totally good process. You go to the library and you like just pick a book on the subject matter, on the subject matter of American history. And most of those books are unbiased. Some of them are biased towards sort of thinking that slavery was the main reason why the Southern states seceded. Some of them are biased towards thinking that it's it was state rights that were the main reasons. But you just happen to end up, you know, just by chance, you get the one that's biased in one direction towards thinking that it's that succession was driven mainly by states' rights. And now you read it all, and now you have all this evidence. Then what is the is that evidence biased that you have? Is your evidence biased on the sort of defeat account, or more generally on the historical account? It's not clear that it can be, because the source of your evidence, the process by which you got your evidence, has to specify like how you got that you went to the library and that you picked a book at random and so on. And that kind of information doesn't make it any more likely that you would have ended up with information that supports succession was driven by states' rights than by slavery. The reason why I don't think it's decisive is because there's a very... is that what happens here is that there's this other body of information, namely the information contained in the book, which the account very clearly predicts to be biased, because that was assembled by a different process. And so you might say, look, that's what's happening here. So when we're asking whether your evidence is biased, we sort of, because the relevant evidence consists of the same propositions as the book, and the book was biased, we sort of mistakenly think that the evidence was biased. But now that we've seen my account, we should recognize that that's not the case. I don't know how convincing that is. This is something to talk about. A few minutes. Excellent. All right. If that's right, what are some conclusions that we can draw? I won't be able to say everything that I was going to say here, but that's fine. One thing that I wanted to come back to was the question of whether biased evidence is necessarily always misleading evidence, which seemed intuitive. It seems like bias is a kind of misleadingness. And I argued that if misleadingness is understood as supporting a false conclusion, then bias and misleadingness are just orthogonal. But you might think that notion of misleadingness, even though it's how philosophers normally define it, is not really what we intuitively have in mind when we say that some evidence is misleading. Here's a feature of this notion: is it makes charges of misleadingness extremely committal. When you say something like, when someone uses a statistic, say the statistic about the U.S. The British proposals being most likely to be voted down in the European Parliament, and then you say that statistic is misleading, you're committing yourself to thinking that statistic supports the falsehood. And you might think that's not. Suppose the relevant question here is whether, Britain has a harder time having its opinion heard in the EU than other countries. Now, I feel like when you're pointing out that statistic is misleading because, Britain tends to put forward proposals even when they know that they have no chance of getting it through, you're not making anything as strong a claim as the conclusion that you're trying to support there is definitely false. All you're saying is that particular statistic should not be evidence that the conclusion is true, which is a much weaker claim. Now, I don't know how to properly analyze this notion of misleadingness that we have here. Roughly the thought is something like, to say that some information is misleading, when we intuitively say that, is not to say anything about whether it supports a truth or a falsehood. It's to say something like, there's a defeater for it. There's something, some other truth that I can appeal to, such that when you put those two together, the evidence no longer supports the thing that you wanted to support. The problem with that is that unless you put some restriction on what kind of information, what kind of sort of truth you can add here, the account will make far too many things misleading. But I'm not trying to solve that problem. All I'm trying to point out is that this is at least a natural way of going, is that there's some truth of some, in some sense, some sort of restricted quantification sense that undercuts the support that the evidence gives to. I think that's what it is for it to be misleading. Now, if you think that that's an intuitive account of misleadings as we ordinarily, then I take it that on the account I've given, bias is also a form of misleading evidence. The relevant truth here being the truth about how the evidence was compiled. Because the whole account says that the truth about how the evidence was compiled would defeat the sort of force of the evidence, or force of the information, and how it bears on the view. That's what it is for the information to be biased, and that presumably entails that there's a defeater of the relevant kind, and so that the information is misleading. So perhaps in this view, if you understand misleadingness right, you can recover the consequence that, or the intuitive thought that bias is a form of misleading evidence. And there. Thank you.